This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
This meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order, and I'd ask that the Secretary call the roll.
Senators Blair.
Here.
Kennedy.
Here.
Nordstrom.
Here.
Schoenbeck.
Aye.
Stalzer.
Here.
Rush.
Here.
Russell.
Here.
Mr. Chair, you have a quorum.
Thank you so much. We also have minutes from the last meeting. We have a motion and a second by Senator Stalzer. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. At this time, it will be, I think, our last opportunity to see our interns. So if you'd come forward and remind us of who you are and where you're from and all that stuff, we'd appreciate it.
Pages,
I'm sorry. I just promoted you.
My name is Ella Hand. I'm a senior at Stanley County High School in Fort Pierre, and I plan on going to SDSU to major in biology next year.
And have you enjoyed your time here?
Yes, very much.
What was the most fun?
Yeah, definitely.
What'd you say?
His candy's on his desk. Yeah, after session every day, we get good chocolates, yeah.
Hi, my name is Megan Linke. I'm a senior at Woonsocket High School, and in the fall, I plan to attend SCSU for nursing.
Very good. Now, have you been at all these after, in the evening events that my daughter's been attending?
I know a bunch of us went to that the rib supper or dinner the other night, but.
Well, I hope you had a great time. Thank you for all that you have done. We appreciate it. Okay, we are ready to start, and we had a request from Senator Schoenbeck to run with his bill first. So we'll get into Senate Bill 80, an act to revise certain sheriff's fees and costs. Senator Schoenbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Lee Schoenbeck, District 5, Watertown. And I'd ask if the chairman of the committee, there's an amendment that's pending, if that could be made a part of the bill, please.
Do we have a motion?
So moved.
And we have a second by Senator Stalzer. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Schoenbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, in 2016, the Sheriff's Association and the legislature worked together to try and standardize the many and assorted fees that had existed in different places in the code, in all likelihood going back to statehood days. And they missed a couple. And in fact, after the bill was drafted, they realized they missed a couple more. And so hopefully this is the completion of that project to standardize the fees. The first section has to do with distress warrants. The second section is actually state warrants or taxes that they collect. And I have Riker in here, Mr. Chairman, as well as a sheriff and a deputy sheriff here that would like to address this.
Very good. Thank you. Further proponent testimony. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary. My name is Riker Teason, and I'm a registered lobbyist for the South Dakota Sheriff's Association. We bring forward to you Senate Bill 80, dealing with sheriff's fees. And in this bill, they're seeking to change the fees in which sheriffs collect on distress warrants. Now, these distress warrants are warrants executed by sheriffs to collect unpaid taxes. And this was noticed by one of the sheriffs as he's been training new sheriffs on civil process and execution of warrants, and realized that this was overlooked in 2016, and we seek to rectify this issue. And I will pass this off to couple of sheriff's offices to clarify on more specific issues. But thank you, and ask for your favorable vote. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 80. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Tim Wahlberg, and I'm with the Lake County Sheriff's Office. As record said, in 2016, we had worked to revise the fees for how we work with executions and distress warrants. Distress warrants were just forgotten about during that one, and I'll take the blame for that. But once it was discovered, we want to make the fees the same as they are with executions. Right now, it's just kind of a sliding scale up and down. We want to bring those fees back to how they're comparable with the executions. There's a lot of different moving parts with the distress warrants. Distress warrants are issued by the county treasurer, and they can come from various different sources. Other than collecting taxes for the county, they can also come from the Department of Labor and the Department of Revenue. So with that, we hope to have this bill completed and in line with how we collect fees on the executions. Kind of a good short synopsis of how this worked. If anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Thank you, Sheriff. Further proponent testimony. And we'll call you up if we've got any questions. Sure. Thank you. Good morning.
Morning. Morning, committee members. I'm Sergeant Ryan Qualseth. I'm with the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Office. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. Like Sheriff Wahlberg said, we started looking at the distress warrant fees and how they're inconsistent with the execution fees that we have. To try and keep that consistency throughout the state, it also helps for the training of new sheriffs and sheriff's office, deputy sheriffs. This bill would standardize those fees between executions of judgment and distress warrants. This is not a revenue bill for us. This is a neutral revenue bill for a large county. This isn't making us any more or any less. It's just for consistency purposes and for the ease of figuring out these commissions and fees for the many processes that we do. In Minnehaha County, we do approximately 1,000 distress warrants and 1,200 executions on judgment. So keeping those fees consistent and the same is much easier for us. If you have any questions, I'll definitely be available.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 80. Further proponent testimony. Hearing none, opponent testimony. Also hearing none, are there any questions by members of the committee? I have one, probably for the sheriff. I have, I'm interested in the, it says $50 or 6% of the amount due. Is that consistent with the execution statute?
Yes. It is. It's 6% or $50 with a $50 minimum on the executions. So that would be directly in line with that statute.
Okay, very good. Any further questions? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion. Senator Schoenbeck?
Mr. Chairman, I would move to pass on this really outstanding piece of legislation.
Is there a second?
Sir.
By Senator Blair. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, I'd ask the secretary to call the roll.
Senator Blair?
Aye.
Kennedy?
Aye.
Nordstrom?
Aye.
Schoenbeck?
Aye.
Stalzer?
Aye.
Rush?
Aye.
Russell?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, you have 7 yeas.
Motion passes unanimously. Without objection, it will go on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that can go on there because of the fee issue.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We think it's revenue neutral, but there's ups and downs, so I don't think it can go on consent.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll give you an opportunity to pitch it.
Yeah.
How's that sound?
Senator Blair offered to cover that for me this time.
Okay, very good. The next bill we have on the agenda is Senate Bill 64, an act to prohibit capital punishment for any person suffering from a severe mental illness. Now, it's according to the sponsor, Senator Rush, we may have some kind of an amendment in the works with the Attorney General's office, so we'll take all of our out-of-town testimony, let Judge Rush present the bill, and then we'll take any out-of-town testimony and defer action on it until whatever date Senator Rush would like. So with that, we'll open it up for Senator Rush to explain his new bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Art Rush. I'm District 17. And I guess I'd start out maybe by asking for my Hog House Amendment 64B, that be that amendment be adopted, and then we can proceed just on that issue, although there are other issues that we need to take the deferment for. But
is there a motion? By Senator Kennedy, a second?
Second.
By Senator Nostrup. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay. So let me talk about 64B and the whole proposal here. As most of you know, that I have a fairly close connection with the death penalty. I presided over the trial of Donald Mohler and sentenced him to death and spent a year of my life preparing for and trying that case. And some saw how hard it was on the court personnel, on the jury, on everyone concerned, saw how expensive it was for Lincoln County to pay the expenses of that death penalty case. And this is what causes me to be involved in this particular action. What we've been talking about recently is whether the death penalty should be applied to people who are seriously mentally ill. And I'd just like to repeat some brief testimony in that regard from Dick Travis, who testified in 2017 in regard to that issue on behalf of the American Bar Association. And he was at that point a South Dakota representative from the Bar Association to the American Bar Association. But what he said at that time was the American Bar Association does not have a policy that either supports or opposes the death penalty generally, but it has extensive policies that are helping ensure capital punishment is administered fairly and with adequate due process. Since 2006, it has had a specific policy opposing the execution of individuals with severe mental illness. This policy was developed in 2003 when the ABA section of Civil Rights and Social Justice convened legal and medical practitioners and scholars from the ABA, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and other interdisciplinary experts to form a task force on mental disability and the death penalty. After more than 2 years of study and deliberation, the ABA House of Delegates adopted the task force recommendation. Among its key recommendations was that an individual with severe mental disorders or disabilities should not be subject to capital punishment if, at the time of the crime, the mental illness impaired his ability to appreciate the nature, consequences, or wrongfulness of his conduct, to exercise rational judgment in relation to his conduct, or conform his conduct to the law. A similar policy was adopted by our partners, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Mental Health America. The policy is based largely on the concept that executing individuals who have a severe mental illness is no more justifiable than executing people who have intellectual disabilities or who were juveniles when they committed capital crimes. The Supreme Court ruled in two seminal cases in 2002 in 2005 that it is unconstitutional to execute intellectually disabled inmates and juveniles who committed a capital offense when they were under the age of 18. As ABA President-elect Hillary Bass explained on recent occasions, and as was expressed in previous ABA legislative testimony, executing defendants in these two vulnerable groups has been deemed unconstitutional because our society considers both groups less morally capable than the worst of the worst murderers for whom the death penalty is intended. They are less able to appreciate the consequences of their action and less able to participate fully in their own defense and more likely to be wrongly convicted. And these exact characteristics apply to people who with severe mental illness. So with that in mind, we prepared the bill here. We've been talking with the Attorney General's office, and let me go back for just a second. You know, why do we take the position that those who are seriously mentally ill should be exempted from the death penalty? And that is because people don't choose to be seriously mentally ill. That's not a choice that they make. It's something that they suffer under for many years, and or many of them for many years. And so it isn't, in that respect, it's not any different than age or intellectual disability. So Senate Amendment 64B does is to move the point at which the decision is made, and I've handed out a diagram that I prepared showing the different stages of the trial. And what it moves it is from I circled two places there on the diagram. It moves it from that guilty but seriously mentally ill up on the upper right hand down to the lower level where the jury considers the aggravating factors and mitigating factors. And that's what the Amendment 64B does. Attorney General's office, I just got that to them late yesterday, so they didn't really have an opportunity to peruse that with any great depth. I know the defense attorneys are concerned that this doesn't provide the level of defense that should be provided for somebody who's suffering from a serious mental illness. So that's why we're asking for a deferment after we've taken whatever testimony we have from witnesses from out of town.
Thank you, Senator Rush. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 64. Further proponent testimony. Good morning.
Morning. Is it on now? Okay. Did you hear me? Okay.
Please introduce yourself again. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah. My name is Steve Manlove. I'm a psychiatrist in Rapid City, South Dakota. I've been practicing since 1987. I do a general practice, but I also do forensic psychiatry. Over the years, I've done probably 1,000 forensic evaluations and probably 60,000 non-forensic evaluations. I've done several capital offenses, capital assessments, people who've done murders, insanity evaluations, competency evaluations, that sort of thing. I have evaluated one person who was subsequently put to death, and that was Eric Roberts. And in that situation, I assessed whether he was competent to accept the death penalty, and I felt that he was. Just so you know, my background in with the death penalty issues. Today, I want to talk a little bit about how people who are acutely mentally ill are like people who have mental retardation or people who have youthful brains. I mean, people below age 18. I want to just point out, kind of piggyback on some of the things that Judge Rush said, that the Supreme Court and then our state laws have held that people with brain conditions, including mental retardation and the undeveloped brain of childhood, impair defendants' judgments and impulse control. Therefore, they should not be put to death. The decisions that came that led that the way to those law changes were Atkins v. Virginia in 2002, where the Supreme Court held that executions of mentally ill were cruel and unusual punishment, prohibited by the Eighth Amendment. The other one with juveniles was Roper v. Simmons in 2005, where the Supreme Court held that the Eighth and Fourteenth Amendments forbid imposition of the death penalty on offenders who are under the age of 18. And they noted that most states did not permit the execution of juveniles, and those with the statutes on the book rarely used it. They noted that juveniles were less culpable than adults based on their vulnerability, susceptibility to peer influences, and developmental immaturity. So the question that the current bill poses, from my perspective, is, are people who are acutely mentally ill, are they similar in some way to people who are mentally retarded or people with youthful brains, undeveloped brains, the juvenile offenders? So does severe mental illness impair judgment and impulse control in a way similar to those issues? And should it therefore be included in the category of people who shouldn't be put to death? So I want to present a simplified but practical way of understanding how the human brain one might view the human brain. So I'd like you to think of the human brain as three brains in one. You've got the brain stem, which is at the bottom of your brain. Some call that the reptile or lizard brain. The limbic system, which is kind of in the middle of your brain, deep inside the brain. Some call that the mammal or leopard brain. That's the reflexive or emotional brain. And then the other part of the brain is the cerebral cortex, which surrounds the limbic system. That part of the brain distinguishes humans from other animals. It's also been called the learning or the executive brain. So the ability to learn, to think sequentially, to make complex decisions, to have insight, and control impulses all come from the cerebral cortex. As long as the cerebral cortex, the outside of your brain, is working and is functional, one would expect you to be able to control impulses and manage your impulses that are presented to the brain by the middle of the brain, the limbic system. If you didn't have mental retardation or immaturity or acute mental illness, you have the ability to make sound judgments and control impulses. But when you're mentally retarded, immature, or acutely mentally ill, the communication between the cerebral cortex, that part of the outside of your brain, and the limbic system, that's the emotional or reflexive part of your brain, is impaired. During mental illness, the brain may shift control from the cerebral cortex to the limbic system, effectively shutting off the cortex's ability for nuanced, innovative thinking and sophisticated analysis. You're still conscious. You look normal. You can still speak. You can calculate even. So you usually don't know that the cortex is offline. But what you say and how you act is based on sort of a fight or flight or instinctual response or previous training. Another way to understand the limbic system is that it's the feeling and reacting brain that is interposed between the thinking, the cortex, and the brain stem, which is the acting brain. In this construct, the limbic system is usually under control of the thinking brain but can react on its own, particularly if the thinking brain, the cerebral cortex, is diseased as a mental illness. So in summary, if you're mentally retarded or have an immature brain or acutely mentally ill, the cerebral cortex, for a variety of reasons, depending on the illness, does not manage the limbic system well. During the course of acute mental illness, the limbic system is disinhibited, resulting in poor judgment, impulsivity, and sometimes including in criminal behavior. And it's not... One might say whenever you commit a capital crime that there's some evidence of moral depravity, and I understand that. In this situation where a person is mentally retarded or has a juvenile brain, an immature brain, or is acutely mentally ill, they don't have the cerebral cortex functioning well enough to manage the moral decisions that they have to make as they're kind of sorting out how to deal with a reflexive response to whatever the situation they're in. So in mental illness, people, there's these circuits that communicate between the cerebral cortex and the limbic system, and in almost all mental illnesses, we've been able to define that there's a problem in that communication, that circuit that brings information that makes you think about the impulse that you've got. So for instance, maybe as an example, walking up and talking in front of people, it's scary for me, right? You're all going to be critical of me. I don't know what you're thinking and all that stuff. And I might say, well, because of that, I'm just going to get up and run out of the room. That would be what my limbic system might tell me to do. But my cortex says, well, no, I can reframe that. I can put it in perspective. I can see that you folks are, you know, all here doing a specific job. You've got different biases. You've got different opinions. That's all fine. And I've got something that's important that I want to tell you. So I came up and I sat down and kind of presented myself. If I didn't have that functioning, if I didn't have the cerebral cortex to kind of help me gain perspective and understand the situation, then I would have jumped up and ran out of the room. Or maybe got up and screamed at you because you don't agree with me or something like that. And that's what I'm arguing. That's why I'm arguing mental illness is similar to other disease or other, not diseases, but other problems that prevent people from managing their limbic system well, like mental retardation and a youthful brain. And that's why, to me, as a psychiatrist who's dealt with this for many years, I feel that that people who are acutely mentally ill should be put in the same category as far as culpability for crimes as people who have mental retardation and people with a youthful brain. So thank you. Anybody have any questions or anything that I can respond to?
We will have an opportunity to ask questions in just a little bit, but we thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 64 as amended. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. I'm Phyllis Ahrens from Sioux Falls, and I am speaking on my own behalf. Also, I will keep this short. Generally, I can go on and on, but I will, out of respect for your time, I'll make this short. I'm here to ask you to vote yes on Senate Bill 64 as amended to abolish the death penalty for people with serious mental illness. As a longtime advocate for people impacted by serious mental illness, to me this is a no-brainer. If someone was so symptomatic at the time of committing a crime that they are deemed incompetent to stand trial, nothing after that time will make the person asymptomatic at the time of the crime. Restoring someone to sanity just to execute them makes absolutely no sense to me. Again, in the essence of time and a little bit on what Senator Rush said, here's a summary of a report from the Death Penalty Information Center dated October 17th, 2019. The American Bar Association has urged the Nevada Supreme Court to prohibit the use of the death penalty against people who are severely mentally ill. In a friend of the court brief filed October 3, 2019, in the case of a death row prisoner, Siasia Vanisios, the Bar Association argued that imposing the death penalty on people with severe mental illness serves no legitimate penological purpose and asked the court to categorically prohibit the execution of individuals who were suffering from severe mental illness at the time of their crimes. The ABA amicus curiae brief argues that executing people with severe mental illness serves the goals of neither retribution nor deterrence, that people with severe mental illness are more vulnerable to false confession and less able to assist counsel with their case, and that existing legal protections do not adequately address these problems. It says the same reasons the U.S. Supreme Court cited for exempting people with intellectual disabilities from execution apply equally to persons with severe mental illness, and that there is no principled basis to treat individuals suffering with severe mental illness differently. On another note, the Murder Victims Families for Human Rights organization partnered with the National Alliance on Mental Illness to speak out against the death penalty for people suffering from serious mental illness. They released a report, Double Tragedies: Victims Speak Out Against the Death Penalty for People with Serious Mental Illness. And I quote, "The consensus of the two groups is clear. Executing mentally ill prisoners is inhumane, unsatisfying for victims' families, and is an impediment to adopting positive mental health policies that could have prevented these crimes. Family members of people living with one of these chronic, no-fault medical illnesses experience so much stress as they desperately try to get help for their loved one. Watching them go in and out of hospitals and jails breaks their hearts. Unfortunately, it too often happens that the person must get incarcerated to get the mental health care he or she needs. This year, though, the South Dakota legislature has been given a great opportunity to address disparities in providing mental health services for people living with serious mental illness symptoms. The summer studies that happened in 2019 have produced legislation that hopefully will keep people experiencing serious mental illness symptoms, keep them living successfully in their communities, and stop the trend of penal institutions being the largest providers of mental health care in our states. Thank you for your attention and your service to South Dakotans. Again, I urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 64.
Thank you for your testimony. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 64. Further proponent testimony. Hearing none, we will open it up for any opponent testimony. Come on forward.
Thank you.
Hi, John. Thanks for coming from Spearfish today. We appreciate it.
Allowing me to be here. My name is John Fitzgerald, and I'm the Lawrence County State's Attorney in Deadwood. I am an opponent of Senate Bill 64. I guess I'd start off by saying it's a privilege that we all have to live in South Dakota, where we don't have the need for the use of the death penalty on a regular basis. It's isolated to only those persons who have committed the most heinous acts, the worst human rights violators that exist are the persons that are eligible for the death penalty. This is unnecessary. We already have a bifurcated system, but what this bill does is it interjects more uncertainty and costs into capital case litigation. And what I mean by that is that all of the things that Senate Bill 64 has within it are actually part of our death penalty law as it exists today. It's a bifurcated system where you first must establish that, number one, there was a first-degree murder, and if the jury is satisfied that there has been, you move into the penalty stage in the bifurcated system. And the second stage is where the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the existence of a list of aggravating circumstances. Those are killing children under the age of 13, killing somebody for money, murdering somebody to eliminate a witness, mutilating somebody while they're alive, torturing somebody, in other words, unnecessarily inflicting suffering for enjoyment purposes, killing judicial officers, killing law enforcement officers. It's a very narrow class of cases that even are applicable or that apply for the death penalty. Those are the aggravating circumstances, one of which has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury. And at that point, anything that would have to do with mitigation is allowed in before the jury. So everything that Dr. Manlove just told you about is perfectly permissible and would be allowed in a court of law before a jury today. And then it's not a matter of do the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances. It's still left with the jury's discretion because they could say lots of aggravating circumstances exist and they've been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. However, we believe even in the absence of mitigating circumstances that just based upon mercy, we should not inflict the death penalty. And as you know, it takes a unanimous verdict in a death sentence. So all of them have to agree to the existence of an aggravating circumstances, and then they have to decide as a group, 100%, all 12, that the death penalty is the appropriate punishment for the crime. If only one of the jurors says, no, I'm not in favor of the death penalty, then that's the end of it. That it's not a retrial, it's not a hung verdict, it's the end of the proceeding, and it's an automatic life sentence for that individual. So this is just going to interject more uncertainty, more costs, more litigation into a system that is well-defined by the court system. Our death penalty statutes and procedures have been approved by the Supreme Court. And now if you add something else in, you don't know exactly where it's going to go. But those are the main arguments. You know, when I've read the bill, the burden of proof is an issue that comes up as far as under that statute, who has the burden of proof if somebody says that they are severely mentally ill? Who has the burden of proof proving that that's true or not true? It doesn't say in the statute. And then it's got a list of severe mental illnesses that says it includes, and then it gives a list, but it doesn't limit it to just that list. So now are we opening the gates to all sorts of other potential types of mental illnesses being used now to basically derail on the front end the state even going for the death penalty? Because as I understand Senate Bill 64, it kind of trifurcates the proceeding. So even before you find whether or not this person is guilty of murder in the first degree, you have to decide whether he's even eligible for that punishment in the event you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt he's guilty of first degree murder. And anytime you take these kinds of life or death decisions away from the jury, you've made a mistake. These things, short of an extremely well-worded waiver by a defendant, should always be left in the hands of the citizen jurors. They're the ones that should decide whether, when they're instructed properly under the law, the death penalty is appropriate or it's not appropriate. Not some sort of a judge derailing this proceeding before you get to the jury. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you for your testimony, and please stay around. I'm sure there'll be a question or two. Further opponent testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, committee members. My name is Laura Retzel, and I'm the Chief Deputy Prosecutor for Pennington County, and it's been my honor and privilege to serve in that capacity for almost 24 years. And I want to start by just really reinforcing how seriously prosecutors take the death penalty. In my 24 years as a prosecutor, I have sought the death penalty only once. In a worst of the worst situation where a young woman was brutally murdered for hire, her ex-boyfriend hired four men to murder her, bury her, and rebury her. One of the things that we really consider heavily in making that very weighty decision is the wishes of the victim's surviving family members. And in the case I'm mentioning, the murder of Jessica Rehfeld, we actually withdrew our death penalty notification at the wishes of the family. So in 24 years, there hasn't been one. We need to remember that we are protecting our mentally ill people by competency. We could never prosecute someone who is incompetent. Let's make sure we're removing that as something different from what we're doing today. and also insanity. No one who is insane at the time that they committed a crime could ever be found guilty. So let's take out that. We're not prosecuting insane people for crimes. So when you look at the bill prior to the amendment, which is what I came here to talk about, the amendment was made late. What you're doing is you're opening up a third stage of litigation that would make it even more difficult to prosecute successfully or unsuccessfully death penalty cases. And that, like State's Attorney Fitzgerald was saying, creates a third layer of prosecution that would be tremendously difficult and ripe for extensive appellate work. My other concern is the definition of severe mental illness. Although I like what you've done this year as opposed to other years by trying to narrow that down a little bit and giving a list of mental illnesses that we would want to look at and consider in severe mental illness. But what you've done is you've said including, not limited to. So you're still opening it up to a very, very wide, extensive range of mental illnesses that just don't make sense as a defense to a death penalty case. The amendment 64B, I think, is much better. But like State's Attorney Fitzgerald said, it's already built in there. We're allowing juries. We want to allow juries to consider mitigating factors. This is a mitigating factor that would come before a jury in a death penalty case already. But certainly the Pennington County State's Attorney's Office doesn't have any objection to the 64B amendment. It's much, much better than what we showed up here for this morning, in my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Further opponent testimony. Hearing none, we'll give Senator Rush an opportunity for any rebuttal at this time. Or would you like...
Why don't we delay that, okay, as long as we're deferring the bill?
Okay, that sounds great. Any questions by members of the committee of those who testified? No questions? Okay. Well, under the circumstances, I guess we'll defer. And when do you want this deferred to, Judge?
Well, I guess it's kind of up to the office and the defense attorneys whether they can resolve the differences. If they can resolve their differences, this may be a very brief subsequent hearing.
The only reason that I ask that question is for purposes of putting the public on notice as to when we'll resume on this bill. Is a week from today adequate?
Yes.
And I will not be here a week from today. That's the day I'm going to be gone.
When would you be back on Thursday?
Oh, let's see, what's today?
Or are you gone for the entire week?
No. Today's Thursday.
Yes.
Next Thursday, I'm going to be gone.
You'll be gone. Okay, so how about two weeks from today? Would that work? We don't have a deadline that we're creeping up on, do we? Okay. Well, we'll give you 2 weeks to try and sort all of this out. How's that sound?
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we have just one more bill. Senator Heinert last night asked me to delay action on his bill or consideration of his bill. So I said that would be fine. We have one more bill, and that's Senator Stalzer's bill, Senate Bill 98. Good morning, Senator Stalzer.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Senator Jim Stalzer from Sioux Falls. And if you can indulge me a second, I was approached this morning by Capitol Protective Services and asked to make an amendment. I had staff do that, and as I reread it, there were some issues that it was very cumbersome. And so I have provided Wenzel with a new version of that amendment.
Take just a few moments? Would you like a brief recess?
So it's just totally when he has it ready.
He's typing pretty fast there.
Yeah.
he,
So if you, I guess if you would like to go ahead.
Okay, I can go ahead and explain what is involved in this. Last year when we passed Senate Bill 115, which was the ability for people with enhanced permits to carry in the Capitol, there was a requirement that you could request that for 30 days max. That process has been found to be cumbersome by both people who are carrying that work in the Capitol and by Capitol Protective Services, in that they have to maintain a list and dates that people have applied for. So as a practical matter, what they've done is they will now allow you to put in 12 30-day requests on January 1st or 2nd, which effectively gives you the calendar year. And so what the intent of this bill is to actually just update what was passed last year to what Capital Protective Services is currently doing anyway. The initial bill that I introduced limited this to people who work in the Capitol, legislators who work in the Capitol, and people who had acquired an access pass from the Highway Patrol or Protective Services. And then the people who would come casually would still be limited to 30 days. I was approached this morning and asked to eliminate that 30-day requirement for everyone, just to make it easier for them to keep track of and easier for people who might be visiting. So what my amendment does, and again, we're going to make sure he's double-checking me and it works, is on page 2, basically eliminating everything from line 2 to line 15, and then putting in a very simplified version. And basically it just says that the notification required by this section then is to include the date on which, or the range of dates during which, the person intends to possess a concealed pistol in the state capitol, providing the range of dates may not extend beyond December 31st of each year. And then the next section is the notification may be renewed as necessary and without limit, which would be for someone who gives them a limit of only a few days and then later in the year comes back for a few days to accommodate that. So with that, I would be available for questions. And
thank you. At this time, do we want to move the amendment? We have a motion by Senator Schoenbeck. Do we have a second?
Second
by Senator Blair. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay.
Is this 98B?
I believe so. It
should be B, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. Further proponent testimony on the amended Senate Bill 98. Further proponent testimony. Hearing none, is there any opponent testimony? Any opponent testimony? Also hearing none, are there any questions by members of the committee for Senator Stalzer?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rush.
Thank you. Senator, am I right in understanding this, that it extends the 30-day period to a year?
That is correct. You can apply for a period of time, or you can apply for the whole calendar year. And again, these are people who have had an enhanced permit. They have already gone through an FBI background check in addition, and monthly the Secretary of State compares the NICS system to this list of people, and if there is a problem, they will have their permit revoked and therefore would no longer be eligible.
Okay, follow up, sir. So under that, would they, the person who gets a year-long permit, will they still be being checked monthly?
Yes, everyone who has an enhanced permit is checked monthly by the Secretary of State, so that the, you know, because of the extra privileges on it, so they could actually have their permit withdrawn or invalidated.
Further questions by members of the committee? Any further questions of Senator Stalzer? Hearing none, I'd entertain a motion at this time. Senator Stalzer.
I move due pass on Senate Bill 98.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Blair. Any discussion on that motion? Senator Kennedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that while I respect what my colleague and friend from Sioux Falls has brought, I opposed concealed pistols in the Capitol last year. I continue to oppose them, and I will vote against this bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Rush.
And maybe that's those of us who've worked in courthouses too long, but I have the same thing. And I, you know, I appreciate what Senator Stalzer has done, and I appreciate the safeguards he's put in here, but I think I voted against this last year, and I'll probably vote against it for that same reason this year.
Further discussion on the due pass motion. Senator Schoenbeck.
Just so my vote isn't misunderstood, I'm just not willing to refight the battle. I don't like the program, but I think the bill doesn't seem to do any new harm.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'd ask the Secretary to call the roll.
Senator Blair?
Aye.
Kennedy?
No.
Nordstrom?
Aye.
Schoenbeck?
Aye.
Stalzer?
Aye.
Rush?
No.
Russell?
Aye.
There are five yeas and two nays.
Motion passes. That concludes what we're able to get done today. I thank each of you for being here, and look at we're done 10 to 9. Sorry about that. A motion to adjourn. Oh, Senator Nordstrom.
Personal privilege, please.
Certainly.
Just came across the news flash, breaking news. Aberdeen-Roncalli is the state of North Dakota state champions. Aberdeen-Roncalli is the North Dakota state champs in robotics, just announced.
Mm.
Last year they won the Nebraska state championship. This year they won the North Dakota state championship, Aberdeen-Roncalli.
Interesting.
District 3, Mr. Chairman.
So does that require us to change the boundary, the northern boundary of South Dakota?
Okay, motion to adjourn.
Well, wait, Mr. Chairman, does this create the opportunity to move some part of District 3 north then? Redistricting isn't that far off. I thought we were bound by state boundaries, but if we got more flexibility.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
If you get an opportunity to visit Aberdeen-Roncalli, you walk in the front door, and there's a great big banner as you walk in the front door. It says, state champion, North Dakota state champions.
Okay. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Yes, so move.
Senator Blair, seconded by Senator Stalzer. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes.